sun is shining. 56 Racine, 53 in Kenosha. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. 10 past 8, the morning show with Greg Burr is next.
And we welcome you to the Thursday morning show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. The book before us today is titled To Stop a Tyrant, The Power of Political Followers to Make or Break a Toxic Leader. And the word break is spelled B-R-A-K-E in that intriguing title. This is a book, to some extent, about tyrants and how they garner power and hold on to it. But it is much more a book about those who follow tyrants. And for that matter, those who, in effect, enable tyrants, who give tyrants their power. And the role of the follower in our daily life, in our life as a society and as a nation, has been a source of great interest to my morning show guest today, best-selling author Ira Chalif. In fact, he is very well known for a previous book called The Courageous Follower. He is, among other things, founder and former president of Executive Coaching and Consulting Associates and chairman emeritus of the Congressional Management Foundation in Washington, which is a nonpartisan organization that exists to help officials on both sides of the aisle more faithfully and effectively serve their constituents. And he's actually the founder of something called the Followership Learning Community of the International Leadership Association, which further explores this notion of the different kinds of followers and the role that followers play in society and modern life, often a role that is not fully understood. And this current book, To Stop a Tyrant, is published by Wonderwell Press. And Ira Chalif, we welcome you to the morning show.
Thank you, Greg. Thank you for a very beautiful introduction.
So tell our listeners at what point in your life, and this is some time ago, that you first became intrigued with something that so much of the rest of us do not think very much about, followers and the whole nature of following a leader.
Somehow you detect I'm not 21 years old. Yes, you're right, Greg. I was born just after World War II. And I lived in a multi-generational household where my maternal grandmother had lost her entire family in the Holocaust. At a very early age, I became absorbed with this question: why do people follow such a terrible leader with such horrible consequences? I didn't have the language then to process that very well, but it was a question that resided in me as I started to figure out what was my work in life. That work eventually brought me to Washington, D.C., about 40 years ago, where, as you say, I found a niche in which I could do work on both sides of the political aisle, which is fairly rare, and get an insider view of what is it like to be in a Republican or a Democratic office where there are 20 or 30-year-old staffers working with 40, 50, 60-year-old members of Congress? And how do those staffers who become influential, what do they do that wins the trust of their leader so that he or she then takes their advice quite seriously and they develop an influence really beyond their years, if you will, but not necessarily beyond their wisdom? They often very quickly learn what they need to learn. This was the background in which and from which I wrote my first book, The Courageous Follower, and the subtitle of that is Standing Up To and For Our Leaders. You have to do both. If you only stand up to your leaders, you're not going to last very long. But if you only stand up for your leaders, you're leaving them blindsided when they need to hear the truth from you, even if it's somewhat unpalatable at first, but is really in their long-term interest. That's the framework on which I come to this work from.
I want to address one really important matter, and you obviously consider it to be significant yourself because this comes up quite early in the preface. And that is the matter that as you talk about this, you do not directly cite anybody engaged in the current race for president. And of course, at the time that you sat down and wrote this book, it was still essentially a race between Joseph Biden and Donald Trump. And of course, now we know things since then have changed. But nevertheless, you do not draw upon any specific examples in this current presidential race in order to make any of your arguments or drive home the point or illustrate what you are trying to say. Talk for a moment about that really important decision that you have made as the author to make this book, in a sense, about something else.
Yes. In the last couple of years, when I would tell people what I was writing about, the most common reaction was, boy, is that timely. And I would say, yes, it is timely. And unfortunately, it has been timely throughout human history. Regardless of what era we've lived in, what continent we've lived in, there have always been tyrants who produced tremendous harm for their people and neighboring nations. So, although obviously the sort of anxiety that existed in the land as I was writing this book was very palpable, and in a sense, I was addressing it, but I made the conscious choice of not addressing it in terms of the current actors, firstly, so that the book has currency far beyond the current election, but also because I had observed that there are many books out there right now on the threat to democracy, and virtually all of them take their argument from one end of the political spectrum or the other, and therefore they're speaking mainly to the choir, to their own side of people who already believe what they believe. I didn't want to do that. I wanted to write something that could reach across the aisle, which, you know, I am a registered independent, and my career in Washington has demonstrated that. And I want to find a way to respectfully get those on both sides of the aisle to look at themselves, to look at how they are getting information, how they are forming their choices, and what are the potential blind spots they may have, and what are the ways they can do to make better choices about who they support and with better outcomes in the long run. So that's why I have not written about the current political campaign.
And of course, the other thing is you also are not writing about these two principal opponents of each other, because this is, in a sense, this is not about leaders as much as it is a book about followers and the nature of those who follow in whatever way they choose to do that. And I think you're right that that is something we tend not to think very much about, and we especially don't think about it very thoughtfully if we think about it at all.
You're right on the mark, Greg. So, you know, let's say that you're someone who's worried about Donald Trump. Well, shouldn't you be at least as worried about the 80 million voters who support Donald Trump? And I can sort of reverse that. If you're worried about the Democratic ticket and what you consider to be the deep state, well, shouldn't you be worried about the 80 million people who hold that viewpoint? So what we're looking at is more fundamentally how, particularly in a democracy, the people who elevate a leader, support that leader, choose that leader, how do they get there? And is there a better way to do that? Now, I know that a lot of people will think, well, no, we don't do it, really. It's just the elites that do it. There's some truth to that, but it's really only partly true. It's more true to say that there is some kind of an alchemy that occurs between the broad populace in a democracy and the elites in a democracy that then give rise to the leaders that contest for our vote. And wherever we are on the political spectrum, we might be an elite, or we might be someone who just attends rallies, or we may be a dedicated activist. How can we make the best choice? How can we make a difference, regardless of our preconceived notions of which party is better for the country, and instead focus on which leader actually is more likely to take us in the direction that we feel the country needs to go to in order to be a vibrant, flourishing democracy?
We're speaking with Ira Chalif, author of a new book called To Stop a Tyrant, The Power of Political Followers to Make or Break a Toxic Leader. Something else that I find laudable about your book is that you are not limiting your examination of this to our own nation and its history. And I appreciate the scope with which you think about this and explore various ways in which this plays out in places other than the United States. Given that, what kind of a challenge did that pose in terms of thinking about this on a truly human scale versus an American scale? That in and of itself would be challenging enough.
I've been very fortunate, Greg, in my career. Based on my work in Washington, D.C., that gave me a platform to do democracy-building work in other parts of the world. So I have been in Eastern Europe after the fall of the Berlin Wall. I saw what was happening in the former satellites of the Soviet Union, how they were struggling to create their own democracies that would be sustainable. I have been to West Africa with democracy building work, and I saw the struggles there. I've met with, I've done tours of India. I've been in Thailand and Taiwan. Again, you know, you live long enough and you get to see these interesting transitions from dictatorial states to sustainable democracies. And we can't take that for granted. That is a really difficult evolution, but it does happen. And I have seen how my work on followership has supported that. I tell the story, for example, in the book of I worked in Nigeria when the Nigerians were making one of their transitions from military rule to democratic governance. My book, The Courageous Follower, found currency there. When I returned the second time, I found that the then President Obasanjo was giving out my book and autographing it to various members of the Senate And, of course, an author just loves that. And then when he tried to change the Constitution to abrogate the term limits to being president, those same senators stood up and said, no, you cannot do this. They became courageous followers. And he backed down. And the reason this is important is that in Africa, where we have a very poor record of political leaders becoming dictators and holding on to office nearly for life, these followers broke the chain. And as a result, we've now in Nigeria had the fourth successive democratic peaceful transition of power. That doesn't mean that Nigeria is a model democracy. Far from it. All democracies are imperfect. But this key piece of the peaceful transference of power is something, again, we must not never take for granted, because it's been the fundamental flaw in all forms of autocracy. And it was really one of the great, great innovations that our founders created, and that our early founders, like Washington and Jefferson, then wound up instituting through their own example, which of course eventually became embodied in the amendment to the Constitution that limits our presidency to two terms.
One of the things that you do in your book is that you take a close look at the I forget now if you call them concentric circles, but the circles of varying size that, in a sense, surround a given tyrant or aspiring tyrant or proto-tyrant. And these are rings in which, of course, each is a little more distant from the central figure, and yet each of them plays a really significant role. And so these are the circle that is closest to that central figure, the confidant circle. Just beyond that, the elite circle. Then we have the operational or bureaucrat circle, the activist circle, and finally at the outer ring, the populace circle, the general populace, or a portion of the general populace. Talk us through those rings of followership, if you will, and what is distinct about each of them in terms of the role that they play.
Yeah, you're doing a great job, Greg, of painting a picture with words for those who can't see the diagram in the book. Thank you very much for doing that. The concept is that to just say there are followers and leaders and followers help create their leaders is insufficient in political life, because access is extremely important. And people in each of these circles that you described have different forms of access, which give them different forms of information, different ways of influencing, create different risks for them. So I disaggregate all of that for each of the positions that a follower occupies. And, you know, these are somewhat fluid positions. So, for example, you might start off as a member of the populace, and, you know, that's us citizens, or even the non-citizens who aspire to become citizens, but we're affected by what our government does. So we pay attention, we go to rallies, we read the news, etc. We may never meet the candidate or the leader, so we can at times feel frustrated, feel powerless. But I argue in the book that we actually have more power than we give ourselves credit for. And I walk through what some of those forms of power are. One of them, for example, is very simply, you know, in an autocracy, the government tells us what information we can have. In a democracy, we have choice, but too many of us limit our information to only one point on the political spectrum. So we wind up sort of creating our own autocracy. And I'm arguing that as citizens, as members of the general population, it's really healthy to listen to positions across the political spectrum and then make our own evaluation of which information has more validity and which are we going to use to inform our voting decisions. So that's at the outer ring. Now, we may decide, we may get so motivated from that that we decide, well, no, I'm not content to just stay in this outer ring. I'm going to become an activist. And then as an activist, we start to work for or against the political leaders who are standing for office. I argue that that gives us extra ethical responsibility, because if we start developing doubts about the political leaders we're supporting, yet we keep luring others to support them, that's an ethical problem. So I argue that we need to pay more attention to our own doubts, and if we start to have those, to figure out how can we convey them to the political leader and their circle of influencers so that they either, you know, change what they're doing that we're not comfortable with, or we make a different decision. Maybe we shouldn't be an activist for them. I don't know if we have enough time for me to go through each of the circles, Greg, but that's what I do.
Yeah, actually, that's at the rate we're going, I think it would be okay to touch, at least touch on the others as well.
I'd be delighted to. So the middle circle, which is the bureaucracy or the operational circle, here's the point. No political leader can get anything done without a pretty large bureaucracy to implement their vision, their plans, and turn them into programs, monitor them, and enforce them. In the United States, that bureaucracy is upwards of 2 million people, and they get different kinds of access, they get different kinds of information, and they have different responsibilities because they are, in a sense, bound by their role to implement what the political leaders are elected to do and what they tell them to do. That works generally well, but what about if the political leaders are crossing lines and are asking them to do things that are unethical? Now we're into a different terrain here where they have to make their own ethical choices and figure out how to do that. And I go into that in great detail in the book, including on how they can develop the political savvy to say what needs to be said, do what needs to be done, and still keep their jobs. And there's an art to that, and I hope that my chapters on that will empower further the political operatives, but the governing operatives that we depend on for so much of what happens in our lives. The next to the inner circle are the elites. And by elites, I don't mean just wealthy people. I mean anyone who can command a large piece of attention. Taylor Swift is an elite. Sports heroes are elite. You're a minor elite, Greg, as well. You see what I mean? The powers that be need to keep in mind what elites are seeing, saying, and promoting. And therefore, that gives them a certain amount of power to influence what's happening. But that power can be suborned. It could be misused. It can make bad choices. For example, I use in Russia, you know, the elites who supported Putin, and then he turned on them and threw them in jail. Because once you give an autocrat that kind of dictatorial power, they can turn it on you. So there's some very serious discussions in the book about this. Lastly, we have the confidant circle. This is the inner circle. Obviously, family are in the inner circle, but so are some lifelong supporters. So oftentimes, whoever becomes president takes people with them who were with them ever since their first campaign in the state Senate and came up with them through whatever path they achieved office to. And these have two things. One, they see beyond the persona of the politician who generally likes to, you know, hide their warts. They see the warts and all. And secondly, they have their ear, and they have the power to whisper to them saying, sir, you're going too far on this. This isn't playing well. And hopefully they will take that in and listen to them. But sometimes they don't. And then the confidants have to figure out what do they do about that. And again, I walk through some of the ethical decision-making there. Ultimately, if a political leader is really going off the rails, and in our country, the closest we came to that was Richard Nixon, who covered up the crimes of the Watergate break-in, ultimately, it's going to take a coalition between the different circles of followers to counteract that. And I go into in some detail how that worked and how our democracy rose to the challenge and then saved us, if you will, from establishing that it is okay in the Oval Office to do those kinds of things. Now, I know the Supreme Court ruling recently has thrown some shadow onto this, but I think there are still lines that are going to merge with further litigation and further experience, and it still is going to become very, very important for those working directly around power to hold them to the established sense of propriety within our government and our culture.
One of the things that you further explore beyond these five rings of different kinds of followers, the different circles, but that within those circles, I mean, throughout, we can look at different ways in which one can be a follower, different follower behaviors. And this can be incredibly important. And I think this is an essential moment in your book, because I think for a lot of us, we too quickly just assume that to be a follower is mostly about playing a passive role. And you really shake us loose of that misunderstanding, that there are different ways in which to be a follower. And even within these five circles of followers, we will find these different behaviors. Outline for our listeners what those are and how important it is for us to think about this.
Thank you for introducing that, Greg. Yes, this comes from some of the scholarly literature on followership and on what's called the toxic triangle, how followers enable toxic leaders when the context, the historical moment, the economic moment, the political moment, will allow a toxic leader to emerge. And there are essentially three types of following from that perspective. The first is what's called conformist. We may not love the leader, we may not fully agree with them, but hey, we've got our lives to live, and we just put our heads down and whatever, you know, we'll go along and do what we're told. That's the conformist. And unfortunately, although it's very understandable why somebody might do that, unfortunately, it opens the gateway for a toxic leader to then hold an outsized sway over what happens. The next kind of follower is more problematic. That's the colluder follower. This is a smaller band of followers who see that their own perceived self-interest lies with this particular, let's call them toxic leader, who gaining the power because they will protect them and they will enable them to advance their own agendas. And therefore, they can push the leader to be more extreme than the leader's own instincts would generally take them in the direction of problematic decision-making. So colluders are very, very problematic. The third is the courageous follower. Of course, that's the title of my early book, but it is also a descriptor. And what is a courageous follower? A courageous follower is someone who will stand up and use their voice as they see necessary. And that could mean in support of the leader. In other words, perhaps everyone around the leader is actually not cutting them enough slack. Leading is hard. leading a democracy is really hard. And the people around that leader need to give them a lot of support to help them do their job. But at the same time, that courageous follower will also use their voice to the leader when they see the leader taking actions that are violating the core principles, the core values on which they were elected, on which a society agrees should be the way we comport ourselves, the way we are governed. They will take a stand. Eventually, this could become whistleblowing. But if it's done really well, it doesn't need to become whistleblowing, because internal correction happens, which is really best for everyone if the courageous follower can help the leader modulate what they're doing. And, it's less disruptive to the society, to everyone's lives. But occasionally, if the toxic leader just will not pay attention, then that's when the courageous follower may need to step out, say, I'm no longer following, and take action to alert the rest of the community to the dangers that they see from the inside.
Hmm. I wonder if a particularly compelling example of a courageous follower comes to mind that you would want to share with us. I mean, a very specific courageous follower by name. Would you have a story of that you'd like to share?
Sure. Well, obviously, because of what I said at the beginning of the program, I'm not going to use any contemporary examples. Not that there aren't any. There are. But I'm a steward of the purpose of this book, which is to let everyone, wherever they are in the political spectrum, think for themselves about what are examples of this. And what does that mean for them? In the book, one of the followers that I take up is Daniel Ellsberg, who became famous for exposing what was being learned in the Pentagon Papers, which was basically that the Vietnam War was going very, very poorly, despite the rosy picture that was being painted publicly for the American public. And this was, of course, there are tremendous consequences to these kind of lies. Hundreds of thousands of lives are lost, ruined, trauma that could be avoided is perpetuated. So Ellsberg, at great personal risk, decided to speak up. He thought he was going to spend the rest of his life in jail. He was fortunate that didn't transpire, but many people at the time called him a traitor. But in retrospect, he was what we can call a constructive patriot. There is blind patriotism, where you just shut your eyes to anything your country is doing that may not align with the values that it espouses, and say, my country right or wrong. And then there is constructive patriotism, which says, I really do believe in the values my country stands for. And when my country falls short of that, I'm going to call it out, and I'm going to do my best to help us get back in alignment with the values that make our country so very, very special and so very precious. And Daniel Ellsberg was a strong example of that.
Hmm. I had the privilege of recording an interview with Mr. Ellsberg some years ago. He was the subject of a documentary that aired on PBS, and I will never forget. I thought I was going to get to do an interview with the filmmaker. That's usually what happens. And instead, the interview subject was Mr. Ellsberg himself. And I realized as I did this phone interview with him that although I certainly knew his name and knew something about his importance at this critical stage in our country's history, I didn't begin to understand exactly what he had done, how he had done it, and the immense risk he was taking on so many different levels. And I guess that really embodies that whole notion of a courageous follower perfectly.
Yes, especially almost in extremis. Many of us can be courageous followers and pay a price, but the price is limited. Some of us, are putting our lives on the line. In his case, perhaps his freedom for the rest of his life. So we do owe a debt of thanks for these people, particularly when they do it responsibly and, take great care in his case to not irresponsibly expose sensitive secrets that could hurt our security. So, there's a right way to do it and a wrong way to do it. And that's wonderful that you had the opportunity to engage with him and get more deeply into his thinking about why he did what he did and how he did it.
It was truly a privilege. We're speaking with Ira Chalif. We're talking about his book, To Stop a Tyrant, The Power of Political Followers to Make or Break a Toxic Leader. Just a couple more questions, if you have the time.
Certainly.
I want to talk about the moment in which you are writing this book, and we've already, of course, discussed why you do not tie in specific examples from the current presidential race. But right at the outset of the book, you do talk about what you see as authoritarian trends, really, throughout the world. And there are actually different ways to look at the current state of affairs in the world. And some would say that in terms of kind of the long, big picture, the arc of history, much of the world is actually moving in a positive direction. But others see the world and this situation, our current situation, a bit differently. And it sounds like you fall into that camp as well. What would you cite as the most significant evidence that, in fact, we see a widespread sort of tilting towards authoritarianism that you find disturbing?
Well, I'm going to change that frame a little bit, Greg.
Mm-hmm.
So first of all, as I said, this has been something that humanity has dealt with throughout our history. And the way I think about it is there are always three things in politics. There's who says I want to lead, who says, okay, well, I'll follow you, and what is the historical context in which that exchange is occurring. Now, in times where people feel more disenfranchised or that the governing system isn't working to support their basic or desired needs, they will tend to be more vulnerable to populists who say, no problem, I'll fix that. In fact, I'm the only one who can fix that. Those are always overly simplistic statements and claims. Governing is really difficult. There are so many competing interests, and skilled politicians have to balance all of those. Now, what happens is when democracy either doesn't actually deliver sufficiently or is made to seem that it's not delivering, and of course, we can be manipulated into that by manipulating the information we receive, then that plays to the populist who can become an autocrat, who can become a dictator and a tyrant. So, fortunately, the communication field is also so complex and varied that in one way or another, usually the information can get out that now the tyrant or the autocrat is taking us too far in directions we do not like. So, as we have seen in some of the recent European elections, a corrective happens. I feel that it's important to do two things that can sound contradictory. One, maintain an historical perspective. In other words, when someone tells you, oh my God, this is the most dangerous period in history we've ever lived in, not really true. There have been many points where we've been in grave danger and have figured a way out of it. On the other hand, that people say, no, nothing to see here, don't look, we're all fine. Nah, not true either. We have to believe what people say they're going to do if they have power. In other words, we have to be fairly mature as political citizens in stepping back, looking at the context in which this historical moment is occurring, and make our own assessment of where we need to put our weight. Do we need to put it, you know, more into the devolving power, or more into giving power to the people who would reform the system? There's not ever, you know, one single answer that maintains true through time and space. So, I'm sorry I can't give an easier message, a more pat answer, but that's what I'm calling for, is for our followership to be more sophisticated and more open about how we evaluate our leaders and make our political choices.
I want to ask you about another point of clarification that you give about your book and what it's about and what it's not about. At one point you say, this book is about the relationship of followers to tyrants, not to tyranny. Can you explain why that distinction is important, that distinction between tyrants and tyranny, in the context of this book?
Right. So tyranny is a systemic condition. You know, we can have racial tyranny, we can have economic tyranny that is so embedded in our system that it takes generations to unravel it and even to really understand what it is and how to start to transform it. A tyrant is a specific individual at a specific time who's going to make a specific impact on whatever our culture is at the moment. I also make the point in the book, and I want to make it here, is even though the book is called To Stop a Tyrant, it is really not about a tyrant. It is about what I call a proto-tyrant. In other words, an authoritarian leader who has the shape-shifting potential to become a tyrant if allowed to, if given enough power. But once they are a tyrant who have consolidated power, it is extremely difficult to dislodge them short of extra legal means, which is not what this book is going into. What this book is focusing on is that when autocratic leaders start to abuse their power, and autocratic leadership by itself is not necessarily a problem, depending on what the times call for, but when it starts to abuse power, and before it starts to consolidate its power, there's a window of opportunity when we can interrupt that trajectory towards that autocrat becoming a tyrant. And that's where democratic societies in particular need to be very alert, and we need to understand the warning signs, and we need to understand our own choices that will make a difference in how that trajectory plays out or doesn't.
You've actually started just now to answer my last question, which is that at one point, in a really intriguing turn of phrase, you say that in terms of being the author of this book, you are trying to perform as a lifeguard. Explain that interesting phraseology.
Yeah. So I understand. Look, on either side of the political aisle, what's unfortunate in our country now is that we're far too inclined to think that the people on the other side of the aisle are somehow completely missing it, that they, how could they possibly think what they're thinking? And this is true on both sides of the aisle. But I know that once people start to believe something and they start to live in a mono information culture, which reinforces those beliefs, that their beliefs have a certain logic to it. And nobody ever shifts those beliefs by saying, someone telling them, you're wrong, you're wrong, you're wrong. So instead, what I'm saying is, I'm saying history is full of people who believed that there was a leader who could save them, who could transform their society, and who then 10, 20, 30 years later were very betrayed by that trust in that leader. I'm saying there are undertows to all of these populist movements that claim they're going to transform your lives and make everything wonderful. I'm pointing out where the undertows are, where the rocks and shoals are, where it might be less dangerous to swim, and how you might navigate those waters. I hope that those who read my book will find that this empowers them to do that much more adeptly than they may currently be doing so.
Hmm. You write at one point, ultimately no leader, good, bad, weak, or strong, achieves anything without the cooperation of the people they inspire, persuade, seduce, or coerce into following them. This book will help you understand and potentially alter this enabling behavior. The book again is To Stop a Tyrant, The Power of Political Followers to Make or Break a Toxic Leader, published by Wonderwell Press, the author, Ira Chalif. Ira Chalif, I so enjoyed exploring your book and talking with you about it today on The Morning Show. Thank you so much and best wishes to you.
Thank you, Greg. Thank you for taking the time to really understand the book so well and to bring that out in the terrific questions you asked me. So appreciated.
Tomorrow on The Morning Show, a conversation with Julia Morales. She is an alum of Second City Main Stage in Chicago, which is, of course, one of the great centers for improv comedy. Julia Morales, with her own Stepping Stone Theater, will be leading a night of improv at the Racine Theater Guild this Saturday evening, as well as a free improv workshop at 5 o'clock on Saturday. We'll be talking with her tomorrow on The Morning Show. Other noteworthy upcoming morning shows will include Monday's morning show, when we will be having representatives of the Kenosha Community Foundation with us. And by the way, this weekend, in the podcast version of The Morning Show, a real gem out of The Morning Show archives, a conversation led by my predecessor as host of The Morning Show, Bill Guy, talking with Augie Schmidt, baseball coach at Carthage College. This interview from back in the late 1990s. Coach Schmidt has just announced his retirement from Carthage. From the WGTD Arts and Other Events calendar, the Invoke String Quartet, a wonderful string quartet which really defies easy categorization, really reshaping the whole notion of what a string quartet is performing tonight at Siebert Chapel at 7:30 p.m. part of the Performing Arts Series at Carthage. Go to carthage.edu for more information. Today is going to be sunny and mild with a high of 72 degrees, a little bit cooler near the lake. Clear skies overnight with a low of 53. Tomorrow, sunny, the warmest day of the week with a high temperature of 83 degrees. And then a decent chance of some rain. A bit of a chance on Saturday, a better chance on Sunday, and temperatures will cool off. This is WGTDHD, Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn, and